Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the program. My name is Simon Barrett, and this week I'm joined by my very good friends, LA-based attorney Peter Haven. Peter, how good to talk to you again.
Oh, likewise. So it's always great to get back on the phone and talk about whatever's going in the current affairs of the day. Thank you so much.
And I also suspect that on the line we have one of my favorite sparring partners, the owner of Sunset Protection, the one and only John Perry.
Hey, good afternoon, Simon. Sorry for calling in late, but the Seattle-Atlanta game is really going down to the wire. Looks like Seattle's going to pull it out.
Good Lord. What is that? Lawn bowls or?
John, I'm watching the same thing, and it's a questionable touchdown right here. It's going to be interesting.
Why do you say that? They recovered the ball anyway.
Well, I thought they made a new rule that you're not allowed to advance it if you recover a fumble. It's the Dave Casper rule. And so
yeah,
I don't know
true,
how that...
They would get it at, like, the half-yard line.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, actually, I think it's a touchdown. So there's our first current affairs topic. John, I think it's a touchdown. I just saw a replay, and it looked like a touchdown to me. So
yeah.
There you go. You're right.
No appeal necessary, Peter.
No appeal necessary. Thank goodness. You know, it's funny because those football rulings are a lot like appeals. You know, the standard on appeal from a trial court decision is very much the same as the appeal to the booth in a football game. It's all reversible error, but... It's true, Simon. As we started the program, this game just had a dramatic touchdown at the final seconds, and it looks like Seattle's going to pull it out.
I'm not allowed to watch such things as football. My wife keeps me on a diet of the girly channels.
Well, What Sweetie wants, Sweetie gets. That's the motto, right?
Absolutely. But I am delighted that the pair of you are both talking about sports. Because that was one of the very diverse subjects that I was hoping to touch on this week. In fact, I'd like to start with an item that most people might well put into the who gives a damn category, the Lance Armstrong saga. Rumor has it he's going to confess his sins to Oprah. And it's going to be taped tomorrow, aired on Thursday. Peter, you're a sports fan and also an attorney. Am I right in thinking that while, you know, Lance's confession might be good for the soul, it might be less so for his bank account? It could open the doorway to some pretty serious litigation.
Well, that is a very interesting question, and I must admit I hadn't given it much thought. I hadn't really thought about the degree to which he could be sued for this, for admitting to these things. I suspect that his camp and his attorneys have already considered the issue, and for whatever reason they're not worried about it. I think it's unfortunate that he's basically – I'm sure he's going to get paid something he's going to cash in some form or another for this Oprah appearance. I just find it hard to believe that he's not going to get some financial benefit out of it. But aside from that, if it's a truly honest confession and he just lays it all out there, I applaud it. I think all of sports is really missing someone just coming forward and telling the truth, which is, look, of course I took all this stuff. I took all the supplements and all the drugs and all the HGH and all the steroids and everything I could get my hands on, and here's why I did it. And I did it because everybody was doing it, and I did it because I was good enough to compete, but I wasn't good enough to win. And if you want to win, you have to go the distance. And I did it for all these reasons, and I always knew that this day would come when I was going to have to admit it. I would like to see some sort of confession like that. I doubt we're going to see it. As far as lawsuits are concerned, I did hear that one of his sponsors, maybe it was the U.S. Postal Service or something, did want some money back from him because they made him sign some sort of disclosure or some sort of statement saying that he wasn't taking any illegal drugs or something like that, and he falsified that. I did hear something about that, and I suspect that's a relatively small amount of money. I assume he's made a great deal of money off of his endorsements and all the things that he's done over the years.
John, I'm sure you're an avid cyclist.
Not.
Let me guess. Your cycle has four wheels. It's very large and has a big motor in the front.
Actually, Simon, I'm a runner. Cycling requires about as much energy as sitting down with a remote control.
But what do you think of Lance? I mean, he's been stripped of his seven Tour de France wins. You know, laying down on Oprah's couch and fessing up that he took the occasional Red Bull. I mean, it might be good for him, you know, to confess.
Right.
But boy, I just see some big problems down the road.
Well, Simon, I'd like to pay a compliment to you. I'd be remiss if I didn't mark this extraordinary development. This is the second topical issue you've explored this year, and if you maintain this pace, you're liable to become a political commentator of relevance and meaning. So keep it up.
What was the first issue?
The bubble and squeak.
Oh, the bubble
really
and squeak. Okay, yeah.
Here's my take. I'm a bit cynical. I look at Oprah as that venue is kind of like the national confessional, and people go there to seek her absolution and forgiveness when I think it's misplaced. I'm reminded of all the people he slandered and threatened, his teammates and people affiliated with the cycling sport. And because of his power and money, he was able to silence everybody who tried to come forward. And I would hope he's apologized to those people and tried to make it right and atone for his sins with them, not Oprah. I think the guy's a con man. He has been. I had great admiration for him. He overcame cancer. And we thought he did everything right. And come to find out, he lied and cheated. And I think we definitely should forgive Pete Rose. It's been 20 years before we forgive him. But I think he's got a lot of contrition to perform. And he should seek out the people who he harmed. And also, I think he misrepresented himself to his sponsors. And he owes them a great apology because they were taken in and paid him millions of dollars under false pretenses. And I think they would have a good case, Peter. I'd like to ask you about that, even though
it's a very interesting question because, you know, at the time that these people sponsored Lance, Lance was incredibly popular. And by the way, I think the Falcons just won. Lance was incredibly popular, and whatever sponsorship money these entities gave to him when he was winning his 5, 6, or 7 Tour de Frances, they got what they paid for. They got an athlete who was very popular, who was winning championships. They got whatever financial benefit comes from that. Now, if there was a particular clause in one of their contracts that said, thou shalt not do this or that, then they might have a contractual claim. But I don't think they have a claim that they were defrauded or ripped off in any way, in my opinion, because they got the benefit of the popularity at the time, and that's what they were paying for. I'm reminded now of what it was that I read in the paper as I was talking about this. He settled a defamation lawsuit with a British tabloid that first published that he was using illegal drugs, and he sued them for defamation. And in the context of that lawsuit, they settled it, and the tabloid actually paid Lance, if I remember correctly, money to settle the defamation claims. And then they signed a settlement agreement that said, this is all settled, you're stuck with the deal. And one of the exceptions to a settlement agreement is if you commit fraud. So what I had read in the paper recently is this British tabloid wants its settlement money back. And that may be a viable case, but that's, I don't know what that is, $1 million or $2 million. As far as these other sponsors, I don't feel like they got ripped off because they got what they bargained for. If there's a specific provision in one of their contracts that said he wasn't going to do any of this, and I'd be surprised if they put that in there, because I kind of think the sponsors might just turn another cheek to this. They don't want to know. They just want the popularity, and they want to get away as far from the scandal afterwards as they can, and they got that.
Yeah, but Peter, what about the concept of unlawful enrichment and the fact now, because of his misrepresentations, those companies are tainted with his offenses?
Well, again, it's an interesting question. The only entity that I remember that sponsored him was USPS. I don't remember any other entity. And I don't think the American public really thinks that these entities are tainted just because these entities were duped like the American public was duped.
About unlawful enrichment.
Well, unjust enrichment is a valid concept, and it basically comes up when somebody unjustly gets money that they're not supposed to get. And the suggestion here is that Lance Armstrong unjustly received whatever he got in the form of the sponsorship exchange between himself and the USPS. And I guess my first reaction to it is I don't think it was an unjust enrichment situation, because whatever they paid him – they got what they wanted in return at the time. They got a tremendously popular athlete at the time. Now, I'll be honest with everybody. I, for one, stopped liking Lance Armstrong. And this is really kind of crazy. But I had red flags about this guy when I read about him divorcing his wife. And his wife, who was a nurse, who nursed him through testicular cancer and stayed with him, and he had 2 daughters by her, and then I read that after going through all that, he divorced her, and then he started going out with that singer. Who was the singer, Simon? Sheryl Crow. And I just thought to myself, well, that's the kind of guy he is. That's just the kind of guy he is. And there was never really any doubt in my mind that he was doing something in the way of performance-enhancing drugs. There's no doubt in my mind that a lot of these guys are doing it. If the American public or other people wanted to believe that he was pure, I think that was naive. I think it's a tainted sport. I think we live in a tainted age of sports when it's hard to tell what's the byproduct of legitimate success and what's the byproduct of these performance-enhancing drugs. And unfortunately, I take the view that I view all these people with a little bit of suspicion.
Okay, but I have to ask the question. We have great ways to detect drugs. What went wrong? Yeah, well, we can find drug usage in the Olympics, but not apparently in cycling.
Well, I know that it's a never escalating conflict, and you see this in every situation where you have an adversarial conflict situation. You know, you have law enforcement and laws that are developed, and the criminals evolve ways of getting around the laws, and it's a never escalating it's an ever escalating conflict. And you know, I remember reading about Lyle Alzado, who was one of the first poster boys for steroid use, and he was a big NFL player back in the 70s, and he was very successful, and he ended up dying of a brain tumor. And before he died, Sports Illustrated wrote an article about him, and he gave a long interview to Sports Illustrated, and he just basically laid it out there in gruesome detail what they did. And one of the things that he would do is they had a system, if I remember correctly, it was Alzado who talked about this, they had a system where you would evacuate, you would urinate, you would evacuate your bladder, and then they would inject a needle into your bladder, and they would fill it with some other guy's urine who was clean. Now, this was done, apparently, back in the 70s and 80s. And that, by today's standard, is a fairly unsophisticated approach to masking a positive test. They had the advantage then of knowing when they were going to be tested and what type of test it was going to be. And there are still rules and regulations that govern what kind of tests you can do and when the tests will be conducted. And I don't know all of them, but people who are close to whatever sport is affected, whether it's football or the Olympics, you know, Ben Johnson went into the Olympics in the 80s and wanted to beat Carl Lewis, and then he was immediately busted for steroid use. But my point is, these guys evolved very sophisticated ways of dealing with the tests. And my understanding now is that a lot of what they use are what are called masking agents, diuretics, other drugs that are designed to mask the presence of the steroids or HGH or whatever it is, eliminate them from the body. And it's gotten so sophisticated that now in a lot of circles, the presence of these other drugs, these masking agents, are deemed to be positive tests because they're indicative of the presence of the underlying drug. And that's why you hear a lot of guys in sports get penalized or disciplined because they have the presence of this drug, and you think, well, who cares? And the answer is this drug is a masking agent. So the point is this stuff is just very sophisticated, the degree to which these guys try to escape detection. And obviously Lance and his people, he had people helping him, a lot of people, were very good at it.
John, I have to ask you, do you think that use of steroids is more prevalent than we would like to think it is?
Oh, it's hard for me to say, Simon. I'm an elder statesman at this point. I would say probably so. There's a lot of money to be made, and people are willing to risk present health concerns for short-term profit. They don't think long-term, and it's very competitive, and a lot of people probably feel, well, the other guy's cheating, so I have to, just to keep up with my competition. And even if it's not the case, I think it's instilled in athletes' mentality that they need an edge. It's always been like that. And as far as the cycling, I remember the 72 Olympics, those female East German swimmers. They're probably all dead now. But they were incredible. And that's really when I first remember it starting. And how could an American compete with an East German? And I think that it became a better performance through chemistry.
It's not just athletes. It's not just athletes.
Yeah, no, not just athletes. Some people, for ego.
Look at movie stars. Look at anybody in your circle of friends who has money and who's just very focused on looking as young and healthy and delaying the effects of aging or bodybuilding or whatever it is as much as possible. I mean, this stuff exists in a very prevalent way. And if you go on an airplane and you pull out one of the magazines in front of you, and, you know, one of those airline reader magazines, you'll probably see an advertisement for something called a longevity clinic. Anywhere in the United States, they set up these longevity clinics, and they show you a picture of a doctor. You know, he's 80 years old. He's got the body of a 20-year-old, and they're recruiting people to come in and get the benefit of medical science to try to look as young and have the bodies that they want. It's all the same thing. And it's very popular, and it's going to get more so. And I don't know what we're going to do about it. Something's going to have to give.
Well, I don't have a problem with supplements, but there's got to be an even playing field. And I don't really know how they accomplish that because people are so resourceful, and there's too much money to be made.
That's right. There's too much money to be made. You look at a guy like Alex Rodriguez. Look at Lance Armstrong. I mean, if you had to take the risk, if you're an athlete and somebody says to you, look, you know, if you're good enough to compete in this business, but you're never going to be a champion, you're never going to be remembered unless you do X, Y, and Z. And if you do X, Y, and Z, you have a chance to really make a mark, to really be remembered, to make a boatload of money, and for a period of time, however long it lasts, to be a rock star. And then at some point in time, it may all get exposed, and by then, people will have already known that you were doing it, and they won't care. You know, these are your choices. Do you stick to your principles and have a mediocre athletic career, or do you bet the house and go for it? Well, you know, almost all these athletes are going to do it. They're going to bet the house.
Right.
Okay. Let's move on to another sports-related situation. I can honestly say that baseball is not my favorite sport. I think it's boring, boring, boring. But this week, the Hall of Fame opted to not induct anyone. The New York Daily Times, a guy by the name of Bodley, did not vote for Roger Clemens, Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, Barry Bonds, and Rafael Palermo, which means that at least half of his ballot was consumed by almost certain lawbreakers.
Well, I think, first of all, I applaud the fact that the baseball writers who are responsible for making these selections into the Hall of Fame, I applaud the fact that they did this. It's not a final determination. These guys are eligible to get into the Hall of Fame at later dates. You know, I don't know what the terms of eligibility are, but they remain eligible, and each year they come up on the ballot. But there is an institutional pressure every year for these guys to let people into the Hall of Fame. And I like the fact that this year, as a group, they decided, you know what? You know, this is the way I read their decision. You know what? We're just not sure what to do with these guys yet. We're not sure how we feel about them yet, and we're not going to let them in. And we don't care how many of their these tests they passed. We don't care if they were prosecuted for perjury, and ultimately the prosecutors couldn't get a conviction. We don't care about anything else. We're baseball guys. We watch these guys play. We saw what they did. And you know what? We don't believe them. We think they were all doing something. And I think they're right. I think they're absolutely right. I think these guys were all clearly juicing on something. And there was another name that you left out, Simon, that I think was a notable name, and that's Mike Piazza. And he was a great baseball player for a number of years as a catcher. And, you know, this was just the era. I just find it hard to believe that any really successful athlete, a baseball player during that era, wasn't doing something. I think they were all doing something. And because it's such a class-wide issue, I'm not sure that we know enough now to say how we want to deal with it. And so they're saying, we're not going to let any of these guys in, and we may never let them in, but we're not going to let them in this year.
Well, okay. I have to say, is it okay, you know, that we just say what has gone, you know, what was the norm isn't the norm anymore.
Is it okay? I think it's okay, but I also think, I mean, what choice do we have? I mean, we're never going to keep these substances completely out of our games, because the genie's out of the bottle. And, you know, John alluded to it earlier. Even if we police our own people in international competition, we still have to compete against others, and we can't guarantee what they're doing. And I think that, in general, the whole athletic community is just susceptible and pervaded by these substances, and I just don't know what choice we have. I think, in my opinion, I actually think in 10 or 20 years, they're just gonna give up. They're just not gonna be able to stop it. And you know, you look at states like Colorado and Washington, and they tried for years to fight things like marijuana, and then they finally said, just screw it, forget it, we can't do it. And I think in 20 years, maybe more, maybe less, people are going to say, you know what, let these guys take whatever they want to take. Let's just know exactly what they're taking, and we'll let these guys be human guinea pigs, and if they want to take all this stuff, they'll take it. And we want to know what they're taking so that we can publish to everybody what they're taking, so everybody can see for themselves, and everybody will know what happens to this guy, blah, blah, blah. And I just think that's where we're going to end up someday. I don't see any way to keep this stuff perpetually out of the game.
Hey John, I love the concept. You know, if you fess up exactly what it is you're doing, it would be okay. Do you agree?
Yeah, to a large extent. I did want to say, Simon, you pronounced those ballplayers' names like my favorite announcer of all time. Rest in peace, Harry Carey. especially Rafael Palmeiro.
That was great. That was great.
I look at it like this. I'd like to see consistency in the Hall of Fame as everything. Of course, that's a Pollyannic held view, but I know a lot about baseball. So as a baseball historian, I think before these guys get in, they definitely need to include Joe Jackson, who has the third highest batting average of all time at .356, and Pete Rose. I think eventually all these guys should get in after a period of atonement or mourning. And
okay, Pete Rose.
Let me
just continue, Simon, real quick. I think that this period in baseball will forever be tainted, and they'll be in the Hall of Fame, but historians will always look back and look askance and say, well, that was when they were all doing steroids. So they definitely deserve to be in on their performance, but their records are forever going to be tainted, whether they're in or not.
Hey, John, for the benefit...
But what was wrong with Pete Rose?
Other
than the fact he liked to bet on the game.
Well, that was wrong. There's no doubt about it. But he's done his penance and is the all-time hit leader. You can't leave out the guy. He deserves to be in, just as these guys do. But I wouldn't have voted for him first ballot. I'd make him wait a few years. But it's been long enough for Joe Jackson and Pete Rose. Let's concentrate on them first. And these guys will all get in.
Well, let's
their performance stands on its own. But
go ahead. I'm sorry, John. Go ahead.
Oh, I think their performance will always be tainted. And people will look at the record books, as I do, and say, well, yeah, but they were aided through pharmaceuticals. And that's what they'll have to live with.
Here's the argument, and I'll let everybody judge for themselves. Here's the argument for distinguishing between, on the one hand, Shoeless Joe Jackson of the old Black Sox and Pete Rose, and on the other hand, all of these guys doing steroids. In a nutshell, all the guys doing steroids, there wasn't any doubt, steroids, and I should say HGH, what we'll generally broadly categorize as PEDs, performance-enhancing drugs. There was never any doubt that these guys were trying to win and that these guys were trying to boost their stats, help their teams win, blah, blah, blah. There was certainly nothing about the drug use which was inconsistent with the pursuit of winning. The reason baseball reacted with such fanatical force to the Shoeless Joe Jacksons and the Pete Roses of the world is Pete Rose was found to have gambled on Cincinnati Reds games while he was the manager of the Cincinnati Reds. Now, I don't think Pete Rose ever did anything in any way that would have jeopardized or cost his team a victory, but baseball was so concerned about the notion that it would be transformed into a fixed game. In other words, the reality of the game would go away. It would now be a fixed thing. And you can imagine what happens to the general public if they're watching a game show and somebody's winning and they're all excited, but then they find out it's all just fixed. It's all rigged. It's not real. And Pete Rose was in a position where, in theory, he could have dictated the outcome of a game, and that sent shockwaves through baseball. Shoeless Joe Jackson was part of the old Chicago Black Sox, or the White Sox, whatever they were, and he was found to have likewise bet on games in which he was a player, and he wasn't alone. He had a bunch of teammates who did it with him. And Shoeless Joe is responsible for the phrase, "Say it ain't so," because a little kid asked him, you know, "Say you didn't do this, say it ain't so, Joe," and he said, "Yeah, I really did it." So that's the argument for why these guys are treated the way that they are. And the argument isn't without sense. I don't know personally where I come down on it one way or another, but the integrity of the game, at least from a fixing perspective, was very much placed at issue by Pete Rose and Joe Jackson, and that's why they clamped down so strenuously on it. Now, it's interesting by comparison to note that all during the steroids era in baseball, baseball wasn't doing anything to crack down on this. They didn't really care because they actually liked the ratings. They liked the boost. They liked the popularity. And baseball was incredibly popular when these guys were hitting home runs out of the ballpark. And it's a lot like that comment we were discussing earlier with Lance Armstrong. You know, were the sponsors ripped off? And did the sponsors even care what this guy was doing, or did they just want the publicity at the time? And I think, unfortunately, in my cynicism, I think the sponsors and also baseball, I think they tacitly endorsed this behavior. They knew it was going on, and they reaped huge profits from it. And that's why they haven't done much and still probably aren't doing enough to crack down on this type of usage. At a certain level, it suggests they don't want to crack down on it, not completely.
John, you're quiet.
I was just thinking a couple historical corrections. Joe Jackson was never accused of betting on games. He was accused of knowing that the fix was in, in the 1919 World Series. He never took any money. He hit 375. I think he hit the only home run the White Sox had that series, and by all accounts, was the MVP of the team.
So he was privy to the notion that they were fixing the game for betting purposes, and he just kept quiet about it. Is that right?
Right, and so did Buck Weaver,
okay,
the third baseman. It was basically four guys who really fixed it. But also Charlie Comiskey had a lot to do with it as the owner, because he notoriously underpaid his players and took advantage of them. For instance, Eddie Sycott had a clause in his contract. He would be paid $5,000 bonus if he won 30 games. Well, he won 29 and didn't get to pitch for about a month. So you could see why guys were upset with the owner.
All right,
and
but the allegation
Rose,
was basically it was betting. It had to do with betting on baseball.
Well, guys were paid to throw the series, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But they were ripped off, too, by Arnold Rothstein. He was the brains behind it, who ended up being murdered 10 years later. But as far as Pete Rose, Peter, he bet on his own team. It could be argued that he would try harder to win.
Well, I pointed out that Pete Rose, I didn't think he ever did anything to cause his team to lose a game. But the point is, he was the manager of the Reds, and he was betting through organized betting activities on that very game. And
right.
And it just was an untenable position for baseball to be in, where it was so apparently obvious that someone who could directly affect the outcome, you just talked about it, an owner of a team, in order to avoid paying a guy a huge bonus to keep him from getting 30 wins, basically kept him inactive for a season. An owner is capable of doing that. You can imagine how a manager could dictate the outcome of a game simply by changing pitchers or changing the lineup or making calls, telling a guy to steal a base when he knows it's a bad time to steal or what have you. So it was just an untenable position for baseball to be in.
I think where the criticism comes in is his bookie would know the games he wasn't betting on. Say, for instance, if a pitcher had a sore arm or, you know, there was something with the team that wasn't public knowledge, Pete may not bet on that game, and that would be a sign to other people to bet against them. So I think that's where the compromise of his position came in. But if you talk to anybody, Pete Rose gave 100%, always tried to win every game. And the thing that bothered me about it was he lied about it for so long.
Well, he got defensive, and he went into denial mode. And after he committed himself to denial mode, he couldn't come out of it. It's probably still difficult to come out of it.
Oh, he's
for the same reasons.
All-time hit leader out of the Hall of Fame. It's absurd.
I see your point. I'm not that troubled by it, because I think the Hall of Fame is kind of, you know, it's a figurative gesture anyway. But let's consider two people. Let's consider Barry Bonds and Pete Rose. Now, as between the two of them, do you personally, John, have an opinion as to which one you think is more deserving of being in the Hall of Fame?
I think equally they are. It's just Pete's been waiting longer, so I think his turn should come first.
Well, you would agree with me that it's purely on statistical data, which is the same thing that you're using with respect to Pete Rose, purely on statistical data, Bonds, I mean, he blows everybody out of the water. I mean, nobody compares to him on statistics across the board. He's like a giant, no pun intended. He ended his career with the Giants. But he's literally a giant in the landscape when you just look at his numbers.
I don't think you could place him above Pete Rose for certainly longevity and contribution to the game, no. I don't even think Bonds had 3,000 hits. Rose had over 4,000.
I thought Bonds did have 3,000 hits.
I
really did.
He had like 2,900 or so,
okay,
and then he retired.
What Barry Bonds did was epic from a statistical category. He eclipsed Hank Aaron's all-time home run record, which was an extraordinary feat, and he demolished the single-season home run record. You know, when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, if you hit 40 home runs in a season, wow, that was amazing. If you hit 50, oh, my gosh. I mean, you were a legend. Barry Bonds, at the end of his career, he was 40-something years old, hit, in a single season, 73 home runs. Now, I am about the same age as Barry Bonds, and I tried to be an athlete for many years. And I sat on my couch watching this guy at my age hit 73 home runs. Now, Barry Bonds is an incredibly talented, incredibly gifted athlete. I was nothing like that. But I know what happened to my body in my 30s and 40s. There was no way on earth that guy could do what he was doing without being on the sauce. Absolutely no way.
Right.
And that would have been impossible but for him juicing on HGH and steroids. And the same thing for McGuire, the same thing for Sosa, the same thing for Roger Clemens, the same thing for all these guys. I mean, if I knew exactly what they were doing, I might have tried it just to see, you know, what my body could do. But I didn't even know what they were doing. But it was clear they were doing something. Now, you know, so statistics that would, you know, Barry Bonds may have been a Hall of Fame caliber player without all this performance-enhancing drugs. But he went from being a potential Hall of Fame player to being arguably the greatest baseball player who ever lived from a statistical point of view. And it was all due, or largely due, to performance-enhancing drugs. There's just no doubt about it. What we do with this information is really kind of a mystery. I think at the end of the day, people are so bottom-line oriented that they're just going to say, well, it obviously works. And if something works, it's going to be very difficult to put that back in the bottle. Somebody's always going to be trying it.
Right.
You know, there's a related topic, if I may, dealing with sports that's actually been in my mind in recent weeks. And I believe it's related to all of this. And it doesn't seem related at first blush, and that is the subject of concussions in the NFL. And I think there's a growing body of evidence that indicates that progressive head traumas over a period of time cause serious damage to these athletes. And it's a shame Sam's not here, because one of the new poster boys for head trauma is now one of Sam's neighbors, Bernie Kosar. And, you know, we've had recent incidents. You know, Junior Seau put a bullet in his chest a while ago. And as soon as I heard that, I knew what caused it. There was no doubt in my mind what caused it. Now, these athletes who are taking performance-enhancing drugs, and many of these athletes who, in fact, are suffering this repetitive concussion-type syndrome, they may also be taking performance-enhancing drugs as well. It's not as if, you know, it's just one or the other. And,
okay, let me ask you a question. I remember Junior Seau. He made a big splash on the TV. Just say ow. He was a great player. Was it due to drugs?
No. I want to be very careful. There's never been any suggestion that I've ever heard of that Junior Seau ever did performance enhancing drugs. Now, I'm not saying he didn't, because I am concerned that these types of drugs are so prevalent that everybody is immersed in them in one form or another. But to my knowledge, I've never ever heard a suggestion by anyone that he actually used them. I think Junior Seau is an incredible physical specimen. And because he was an incredible physical specimen, he was actually able to play in the NFL a lot longer than most people can. And it's just a constant reminder to me of how our greatest strengths are also our greatest weaknesses and vice versa. The fact that this guy could play for 20 years in the NFL, it ultimately worked against him. It's just like Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali fought heavyweights for better part of a decade, and during that time period, because he was so rugged, he took a tremendous number of blows to the head. And every football play, you know, I played football and I was a walk-on. I was a walk-on at Stanford. I sucked. But I can tell you, on every single football play, you're basically butting heads with someone. You're hitting someone else in the head with your helmet. Your helmet and their helmet are hitting heads on virtually every single play, and it's happening every single day in practice. You're constantly headbutting people. And if you do this for 20 years in some big-time situations, you're going to develop these repetitive concussion-like symptoms. And, you know, I guess the real point of all of this is I don't think that the athletes themselves are going to be deterred by this. Nobody's going to be deterred from playing football because they know or they think they could have concussion syndrome. They're all going to say, not going to happen to me, or even if it is, I'm going to do it anyway. And it's the same thing with these performance-enhancing drugs. I'm not going to get caught, or it's not going to hurt me, or everybody's doing this, or I'm just going to do it anyway. The only real control that anybody has on any of this is the control of the spectators. You know, how do we feel about it? And what are we, if anything, going to do about it? Are we going to continue to watch the games and support them and be fans? Or are we going to say to ourselves, you know what, I'm not a fan anymore. I don't even know what I'm watching anymore. I don't even know what this is anymore. And, you know, it's going to be different things for different people, but I think that that may also be part of what happens to our games and sporting events. We actually get to a point where some of us may say, who cares what they do? It's not real anyway, or it's not something I want to watch anymore.
I think you have hit a very, very crucial point. John,
Simon,
should we just stop playing the game of football?
Absolutely not, Simon. And this is all supposition on Junior Seau, but I think there were other factors involved. I really had a lot of respect for the guy, another guy who gave 100%, but he had a lot of personal demons. He came up hard. I think his brother was murdered about 10 years ago. He had a lot of family issues. And
okay. But how many other NFL
what about Dave
NHL?
Dyorson?
Yeah. But you shouldn't deprive people of making a living. They've made tremendous strides with
nobody.
Well,
the helmet. Let's put it this way. Do you ever watch a show called Spartacus? Do you ever watch Spartacus? Has anybody ever watched that? Spartacus is great.
I saw the movie.
It's great. It's a great movie. It's great for guys like me who like to see gladiators and stuff like that. But basically it depicts Roman society with a bunch of gladiators out there. And they're all the stars of their day. And they're trying to kill each other. And they succeed. They kill each other in the arena in front of fans who scream and yell and love it. Just love it. I think we're far more civilized than that in today's world, but in many respects, you know, I think we know that these guys are doing serious damage to themselves when they play these games. Now, they're not taking swords out and stabbing each other in the chest like they do in Spartacus, but in many respects, it's still very similar. Now, I'm not saying that you deny people the right to do this. I'm asking the question, do people want to watch this?
Yeah, of course. And people
participate. I got to tell you, sometimes I watch this stuff. You know, you heard Kurt Warner. Kurt Warner, for those who don't know, was a great NFL quarterback. He led his teams to two or three Super Bowls. He won one Super Bowl. And he purports to be a real God-fearing man. And they asked him last year, they said, listen, how do you feel about your sons playing football? And he said, listen, I love football, did a lot of great things for me, but in all honesty, I kind of hope they don't play.
Well, Peter, let me ask you this. With Junior Seau, he had a lot of business failures, and he was broke. Do you think if he had invested his money wisely, he would have committed suicide?
John, in my opinion, if you want to talk about something like suicide, I can pretty much assure you it doesn't come down to any one particular thing. And I can also pretty much assure you, in my humble opinion, that one of the substantial causes of him committing suicide was the fact that he had a severely concussed brain that had affected his thinking and reactions over a 20-some-odd year period, and in my opinion, contributed significantly to feelings of depression and other symptoms which could aggravate feelings of depression, such as sleeplessness and headaches. And in my opinion, I'm not saying that the financial disaster wasn't a contributing factor, but I also don't believe that in a situation like suicide, there is any one cause to the exclusion of others. I think there are multiple causes. And without a doubt, in my humble opinion, his physical condition affected it. Now, if you talk about somebody who was in a situation who was better equipped to deal with suicidal thoughts than Junior Seau, I'm not sure I know of him. Many people suffer with depressive suicidal thoughts in the darkness and solitude with no friends, no support group, no popularity, no fame, no adulation, no family, no friends. This guy had an entire community that worshipped him.
Well,
so
Peter,
don't you think
a lot of it was handling success and his inability to handle failure because he had been placed on such a pedestal and then he hit rock bottom? And it was depression, but
I don't believe
correlation with his head injuries.
I don't believe that was a primary cause. I think it may have been a contributing cause, but I don't think that was a primary cause. Many people have success, and then look at Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I mean, he was a tremendously successful athlete, and he lost everything, and he's still alive and kicking. Now, I'm not saying that he's a happy camper, but he didn't take his own life. Lots of people deal with this. What you're suggesting is that this was the cause, and I'm merely suggesting it may have been a contributing factor, but the cause, in my opinion, was more deeply rooted than that. Because how you react to those situations as a human being is a function of how your mind works and how your mental and emotional makeup deal with failure. And if your ability physically to properly react or more positively react to these types of depressive events in your life, if that's impaired, then your ability to overcome failure is impaired. Your ability to deal with negative things is impaired. And I think we're seeing too much anecdotal evidence suggesting that there's a correlation between the two. I'm fairly convinced there is.
Okay. I'm going to change the course of the direction completely. John, how do you feel about Al Jazeera?
NFL team? What is that?
No, this is a wonderful subject.
I really don't watch them, Simon. I can't say. Obviously, I did find it entertaining that Al Gore sold his cable channel to Al Jazeera, showing that liberals are as quick to abandon principle when it suits them as they are to condemn others for that same absence of principle. What I've been saying all along about Al Gore, I told Manny 5 years ago, beware of the prophet who profits. And this is another example. He showed that although he champions the health of the planet and environmental concerns, he placed corporate considerations and profit above his supposed principles. I think that's where the story is. I don't have a problem with Al Jazeera broadcasting. If people want to watch them, so be it. But Al Gore selling out to the oil conglomerate, I think, is where the story is.
Okay. So if we look at the current situation, we've got CNN, we've got MSNBC, and we've got Fox. Never quite sure what Fox is going to do.
What about Blog Talk Radio?
Well, that's basically fourth, and it's a very close fourth. It's very close to those big three. you're right, but we are part of the big four, but most people only know the big three. But we are very close, very, very close.
Right. But you got to admit, John, I'm another right-wing viewpoint might not be bad.
What? What? Al Jazeera is right wing?
Well, where would you put it?
I would put him as Arab or Middle Eastern influence. I don't know that they're one side or the other. They're just going to promote Arab culture and politics, I would think. I've never watched it, so I don't know, Simon.
Oh, you should try Al Jazeera. It's kind of tough to break through the...
I'm not that broad-minded. I stop at the BBC as far as foreign networks.
Oh, okay.
I'm glad you mentioned the BBC. I like the BBC.
Yeah. How about the BBC? How do you feel about the latest debacle?
Is that the... Are you talking about the sex offender debacle? Which one is that?
Oh, yeah.
You mean Jimmy Savile?
Yeah.
Well, I was a big fan of Top of the Pops. I love that show. And I'll remember him. I don't know. There's probably truth to these allegations, but the guy's dead. Let him rest in peace. You got to admit, Simon, Top of the Pops was a great show.
So it matters not to Hoots that the cops are claiming that, you know, he abused more than 200 young girls.
Well,
and
Simon,
as far as I've seen,
the allegations were, let's say, groping. I don't know, but the guy took advantage of a hypersensitized adolescent culture at the time, and I think there were a lot of people doing that. If you watch those old shows, it's just not.
How do you feel about Michael Jackson?
Michael Jackson. Well, I actually know people who work for him, so I'd rather not say.
Fair enough. You know, I don't know how much truth there is in these allegations, but it seems to me pretty implausible to think that there are allegations that he did something with 200 minors, unless there was some element of truth to it. And I don't know how much truth there was to it. I don't know why this is coming out now and why more wasn't done about it before. I don't know if it's another Penn State situation where people just turned their heads and looked the other way because this guy was popular or famous or
You can't judge the guy by today's standards. Then what's acceptable isn't now. And I don't think that's fair. It was the summer of love, and everybody was open about it, and birth control had just come out, and people had a different attitude towards sex than they do today, I think.
Well, I don't know how that matters in terms of dealing with minors.
Well, I mean, I've seen him on Top of the Pops, and yeah, he's groping women, but they seem to be okay with it from the segments I saw. I don't know about you, Simon, but it was just like acceptable behavior, and I think
Is this guy like Benny Hill? Is he like Benny Hill?
He was serious. Benny Hill was joking, but no, I'm sure he did take liberties. But I'm just saying, then it was a lot more accepted than today.
If there's a guy groping adult women You know.
Well, some of these were probably under 18.
Well, that's a little bit more problematic, and
I
don't know if it's
asked, Peter either. So.
Well, I don't know if we're just talking about, you know, putting a hand in an inappropriate place over clothing, or if we're talking about something much more serious. I don't know.
Right.
I honestly don't know either,
but the allegations are probably at least sexual battery, yeah.
Well, you know, battery.
The infamous penetration.
There's all kinds of degrees. You know, if you read the grand jury indictment in Sandusky.
Is there a degree of penetration?
Well, Simon, didn't Gary Glitter get arrested?
There are no degrees of penetration if you're talking about penetration of the male member in the female body. There are other forms of penetration with other parts of the anatomy and objects, and they're all basically treated in categorical ways by the law. You know, rape is defined as a very specific type of penetration. Other forms of penetration are forms of sexual battery and assault and all kinds of things. All very serious crimes, very serious crimes. But the law categorizes them in different ways. I don't know what happened with this person. I don't know where his alleged victims are, if they're stepping forward, if they're making allegations or accusations.
Yeah, they are.
As a general rule, you know, and maybe they're motivated by money. Maybe they're coming forth now because there's an estate and they want money, or maybe there's a lot of truth to what they're saying. I don't know. But as a general rule, I usually favor, you know, the truth coming out, whatever the truth is. If people, you know, people have things they want, claims they want to make, let's look at them. Let's see how much evidence there is to support them. And to the extent we can redress any of this, we can, and his reputation takes whatever hit his reputation takes. That's just the price of being a public figure.
Okay, John. I want to go back to politics. But there's been an idea floating around this week that actually has some validity. Mining or minting a $1 trillion coin, should we do it?
John, this you get to take first crack at this one. Hello?
Oh, Lord.
Did I lose John?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I must have talked too much. Forgive me. Forgive me, John. 1,000 pardons. Forgive me.
You got to admit, this is just a delightful subject.
Well, I don't even understand. To me, this just doesn't seem serious. It's not serious. I don't understand how this works. So, in theory, someone has suggested that all we have to do is mint, I assume it's a single $1 trillion coin.
He's back.
Oh, thank goodness. John, thank goodness. I'm sorry. I felt like I cut you off somehow.
No, hang on. Let me bring him online. John. Are you with us again? Or,
yeah, Simon, it was operator error. Sorry about that.
We were discussing the $1 trillion coin idea.
Oh, yeah, someone came up with that.
Well, no, it's in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, I think last week I said just print $16 trillion bills.
Well, so,
that's
it's the same thing. I mean, whether you call it a $1 trillion coin or $16 trillion bills, it seems to me it's the same thing. If you need to pay somebody off, just go to your go to your money printer, print out some money, and hand them the money. If that's what people are suggesting, I just don't think that's going to work.
Well, the only other alternative is manage your budget and don't spend more than you take in. That's not going to happen.
Well, what's being suggested with this trillion-dollar coin is basically just a metaphor for what you just talked about, John. It's just printing a trillion more dollars. And the problem with that is that you immediately devalue the currency when you do that. So $1 trillion isn't worth $1 trillion. It's now worth a lot less. So
right.
It just doesn't, you know, it's a nice concept in theory. What it's really suggesting is that somebody wants to take a magic pill or wave a magic wand and make this whole thing go away. My suggestion is that there should be a universal reboot, bankruptcy default, just basically around the world, and everybody should just sit down and erase their debts and start from scratch, and there should be some sort of, you know, international community agreement to this effect, and we should also do it on a domestic level and just reboot the whole economy, everybody across the board.
Reward the irresponsible and punish the responsible.
If the irresponsible are irresponsible, they're going to continue to be irresponsible. They're not going to be better off. If the responsible are so well off, then they've got a lot of cash and assets on hand, and they're not going to be hurt by this. And, you know, it's the only chance to give – and that's what bankruptcy does. It gives everybody a fresh start. So if an individual can declare bankruptcy, and if municipalities can declare bankruptcy, and sports teams can declare bankruptcy, and governments, state governments can declare bankruptcy, why not just have a national, international bankruptcy, just have a day when the whole world's debt just gets extinguished in one fell swoop and everybody starts from scratch? I think it would work. I think that's a lot more meaningful suggestion than printing a $1 trillion coin or printing $1 trillion more. I think immediately you'd bring life back into the international economies everywhere.
Peter, what happened to consequences for your actions?
Well, look, I'm just telling you, what are the consequences to your actions? If you're in debt and you can't pay your bills, you go bankrupt. That's a consequence. There's no such thing as debtor's prison. You can't execute someone because they don't pay their debts. You can't imprison them because they don't pay their debts. If they go bankrupt and they can't pay their debts, they get a bankruptcy.
Yeah, but also they have bad credit and they can't borrow anymore for a while.
Okay, there's your consequence. That's fine. Don't loan to them anymore. Don't give them any more credit. I think that would be a blessing in disguise. Now, the answer to your question is that in the real world, somebody's still going to conjure up a scheme to sell these people credit, or they're going to sell them secured credit cards, or they're going to do what most Americans do now, and that's basically they stop using their credit card, and they basically use their bank account as a kind of secured credit card, check/Visa card, which is the way it should be.
Okay, so you tell all these bondholders, sorry, we don't owe you that money, that 10-year or 30-year note,
You know, maybe you make exceptions to this rule. I'm talking about a concept here. It's a concept that basically already exists. It's just a question of how broadly you apply it. If somebody declares bankruptcy right now, there are certain debts that are excluded from bankruptcy. Okay, and if you are a secured lender, and you have a security interest in property, if they declare bankruptcy, then you win. You get the property. So
what about the people who invest their retirement municipal bonds?
Retirement savings and 401ks are typically excluded from asset collection. So I assume in this type of scenario, you'd find exceptions or exclusions for those types of debts.
So you would just not pay the Chinese back?
Well, I would like to not pay the Chinese back. Yeah, I would like that. I would also like, at the same breath, for whatever debts people owe us, as part and parcel of forgiving their debt, our debt to them, they forgive vice versa, and so on and so forth. I don't know what else to tell you. You want to print a $1 trillion coin? That's not going to work.
I think it would be just as effective as what you're suggesting.
I disagree with that. I disagree with that. You print $1 trillion more, suddenly your debt goes from whatever it is to a whole lot more because the value of your dollar just got a whole lot less.
What kind of interest rate would the government have to pay then to get any additional loans after defaulting?
I don't know. Same interest rate that consumers have to pay after they default on their mortgages and go bankrupt. I don't think the interest rates need to be affected. I think people just need a fresh start. The whole friggin' world went crazy. They overspent, they overindulged, they overextended, they bought and bought and bought, and now everyone, I think this approach makes a lot more sense than doing what we did, which is just dump tons of money into the hands of the people who created the mess in the first place. Bailout, 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 more spending, blah, blah, blah.
Hey, John, you have to admit that, you know, the Feds bailed out banks,
AIG,
automakers, insurance companies, but did they bail out the likes of you, me?
They didn't bail out me.
Well, Simon, we don't have a lobbying group. That's not the point. They're wrong to whoever they go to. I don't like the attitude, well, because they were wrong with the big banks, I should get a cut. It's bad economics because someone's paying for that.
Well, what's your cut, John? How are you hurt by that? How are you hurt? Do you have are you a money lender? Do you have a lot of borrowers who owe you money? Is that what's going on? Or you just want to keep other people from getting a break?
I want to practice sound economics, which I think benefit everyone in the end, not favored entities at the expense of working people.
Well, that sounds very nice. I'm not sure what that means, but that sounds very nice.
That means practice sound economics across the board. Don't bail out anybody.
So
you say print more money?
No, I don't say print more money. I say spend what you take in.
Okay, well, it's too late. Some people are in over their heads. Some governments are in over their heads. Institutions are in over their heads. That's what bailouts were all about.
It's never too late to do the right thing.
It sure is for some folks.
But, John, take a deep breath. Count to 10. I mean, how are you going to fix this?
You can't. You can't fix this. This is a mess.
Simon, I told you last week, if you recall, we need to grow the economy, bring in more taxpayers, not entitlement recipients. You got to grow the economy.
Okay. So let's take this step by step. All right. How are you going to draw more taxpayers?
I would say this. There's a lot of money overseas. The government could easily tell these corporations, bring the money back. You're going to be charged 10% or whatever, and we expect you to promote or expand your business and hire people. Now, if they brought
that
the money
sounds
back,
like it would work.
It would be at 35%, so they're not going to do it.
Okay. So step one is not to do, not to make any concrete step. It's just to threaten people.
Offer an amnesty to all tax amnesty to all corporations, giving them an incentive, not to force them, giving them an incentive to invest in this country, so we're globally competitive, so they'll bring that money back here instead of putting in a Swiss bank account.
Okay.
So I don't understand that. I understand that. So you have a company that's overseas. Now let's define that. What exactly does that mean if they're overseas? And give me an example of a company that's quote unquote overseas. And are you just saying they're doing their labor work?
75% of the workers are overseas.
Okay. So you had some big company in America. Let's call it ABC Inc. And it's huge. I like a better name. Let's call it Massive. Massive Inc. And they have 5% of their workforce overseas, and they're having 5% of their workforce overseas because it's cheaper and they get better work product. And by overseas, we pretty much mean China. So they're building all their products in China, and they're selling them here in the United States. And you want to give them tax amnesty. Now, what exactly does that mean?
I told you, they could bring the money to this country and invest in our workforce.
Well, I don't know what tax amnesty means. That means they don't have to pay income tax?
I would say a small amount, if at all. Yeah, as long as they agree to create jobs, I would give them complete amnesty. But if you wanted to say 10%, that might even do it. But I really believe people would rather produce in this country if the costs are competitive, because if they're overseas, they still have to ship it here, which isn't free.
All right. So
and
what you're saying...
And you're dealing with foreign governments, which may not be as friendly tomorrow as they are today.
Well, the way corporations typically work is corporations typically, let's say they generate, you know, $10 billion in revenue. What the corporation does is it basically spends everything it takes in. The corporation makes $10 billion, and it has all these costs and expenditures. It has salaries. It has payroll. It has all this, all that, blah, blah, blah. And then the remainder, in a typical scenario, is distributed to the owners of the corporation. So I don't know how it works at big business, but the general corporate model is it has zero income at the end of every year, because the whole reason the corporation exists is because the owners make money off of it. So in theory, the corporation itself, in a hypothetical world, isn't paying any income tax. It's the owners of the corporation, the employees of the corporation, who are paying the income tax, because that money gets distributed to them. So I don't, you know, what you're saying is, don't tax the shareholders of the corporation on the zillion dollars that they make, or in distributions, or the officers of the corporation, don't tax them. And instead, give them an incentive to have more jobs here in America. So what you're saying is don't tax the shareholders and the officers and directors of the corporation, or reduce their taxes, if they promise that the workers will be employed here in the United States. And you know, I honestly don't know what's going to happen in that kind of scenario, but that's essentially what you're suggesting, right? You're saying don't tax those guys.
Well, there's a difference. You're describing an S corp, which has to zero out at the end of the year. A C corp can accumulate funds and leave the money in the account for years where they're not as profitable. So that's not true that they zero out at the end of the year.
Okay, so you're talking about a C corp. So a C corp is one where, you know, you say to this company, if your profits at the end of the year, your income at the end of the year, absent all expenses, is whatever, $10 billion, mm-hmm. You say don't tax them at all, in which case we're giving up a massive tax revenue.
We're not, because we'll never get access to that money unless they bring it back, and they're not going to.
Well, access to the tax money, which is right there to be taxed right here, right now.
Oh,
or you're saying,
no, I'm saying if it's held abroad.
If the money's held abroad. So when you say overseas, you're not talking about a labor force overseas. Now you're talking about basically putting money into overseas bank accounts.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay,
and paying taxes to whatever country you're engaged in business.
Well, you pay taxes based upon where you reside, and your income is
personal,
attributed
I'm
to that.
Personal, I'm talking about the company physically overseas depositing money into Luxembourg, say.
Okay. So now they're just out of the country altogether. There's basically just a company operating in Europe.
Yeah, or on paper. Yeah, they're a Luxembourg corporation.
Well, I don't know. I'd have to give this one a lot more thought.
You've got to incentivize people for bringing that money back to this country, and the only way you're going to do that is lower the rates and be competitive globally.
Well, again, those sound great, but when you start breaking it down into details, you've got to get money back in the country. So,
Peter,
again, you're
no
saying—
loss. We would never touch that money unless they bring it back here. That's what I'm telling you.
1%
is better than nothing.
Well, okay. Sounds like a complicated scenario to me, but, you know, what do I know? I'm just a simple guy.
I am, too. That's
John,
why it's
John,
me, so.
How would this actually work?
That's the part I don't get.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like,
I'm just
it's a
simple
solution.
Guy.
it's a solution that sounds great when you say it, but when you start trying to implement it, I, for one, just don't understand how it gets implemented and how it works and how it benefits us at the end of the day. It sounds great on the front end. Get the money back, incentivize people, help the common man, you know, cliche, cliche, cliche. But I don't know where it really goes.
All right, Peter, very simple. A company has $100 million in a foreign account.
And where's the company located?
It doesn't matter. Pick a place. And you tell them, look, bring that money back here, and we'll only tax you at 10% or whatever number you want, and invest that money here, start a company, and we'll keep your taxes low, and just hire more people, which will mean more people are paying taxes and producing.
All right. So Company X, apparently it's not a U.S. company. It's a company based in France.
Well, it could be both. They have whatever you want to say, whatever
you seem to value the pool of money sitting in some bank account as a huge taxable resource. I don't know if I see that. You know, to me, the great end game at the end of the day is, whoa, we got to get those savings accounts back here in the United States because, we need to have private citizens in the U.S. that have lots of money in their savings account because that's going to help our economy.
Well,
that doesn't make sense
hope
to me.
That they'll invest it.
You hope. Well, if we get that money back here, they're going to start investing it. I don't know. People act with self-interest. People, to me, just want to accumulate as much wealth as they can, and they don't want to share with anybody if they don't have to.
Well, I don't believe they're just going to suddenly go lie on the beach the rest of their life. They're successful businessmen.
Well, I don't believe they're going to start, you know, sharing money with any less fortunate, less wealthy person as themselves for the same reason you just talked about. Why should I help those deadbeats?
It's creating additional wealth for themselves by expanding their business here instead of a foreign country.
Well, that sounds great. I just don't know how it gets implemented. I don't know what that means in the real world.
Well, I thought I explained it to you.
Well, you didn't. You just said, incentivize them. Get them back here. We get that $100 million account here at Bank of America located at City X in downtown U.S. Main Street, and that's it. The world's going to be a better place because that money sitting in that account is going to help our economy.
Well, you're making assumptions I don't agree with.
Okay. Fair enough. I don't understand.
They're going to expand their business with that money. That's what I'm saying, and make more with it.
Okay, so
these are rapacious capitalists. They always want to build their business, Peter.
Is somebody feeding you information in the background? Is that what I just heard? That reminded me of a moment with Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, my better half is saying, get off the phone.
Well, God bless you. That explains why you're so smart. You have the benefit of a wonderful woman behind you. I'm just a poor knucklehead guy trying to make sense of the world.
That's telling me I've procrastinated long enough. Mow the lawn.
Well, I'm telling you, a great woman behind a great man, no doubt about it. I'm just like one of those Hollywood prop buildings. I'm just a two-dimensional flat guy. There's nothing behind me.
You're very modest, like Simon.
I'm beaten into humility by all the events of the world. What about John? You must be a great Ronald Reagan fan. You must be a great Ronald Reagan fan.
One of my idols, of course.
I knew it. Every time I meet a good red-blooded American conservative, I always know that their hero was Ronald Reagan.
I hope you're bowing your head in honor.
I'm bowing my head in honor. I remember when Ronald Reagan was trying to answer a question, and he kind of stuttered for a little bit, and you could hear Nancy in the background say, just tell him you're doing the best you can. And he said, I'm just doing the best I can. And I thought, that's beautiful. I mean, it's wonderful to have somebody helping you. And you know, that goes on in every presidency, not just Ronald Reagan's. But
I guess Nancy was his teleprompter.
Well, Nancy was loyal and wonderful, and God bless him. God bless all of us that, he had a good woman behind him. That's what every man needs, no doubt about it. Simon,
okay.
I'm sorry, gentlemen. But it would be remiss not to indulge in some Ronald Reagan references. He is a great American hero.
Gentlemen, I have to break in. I enjoy the things that both of you talk about. John, give me your final thought.
All right, Simon. Let me respond to what Peter talked about earlier with responsibility, because this has always been a hot-button issue for me. And I'll relate it to my own experience in law enforcement. And it has to do with accepting responsibility and being consistent, and that's what I strive for, as well as clarity. So, Peter, after I explain this or give you this anecdote, maybe you'll understand why I'm opposed to just bailing people out, or maybe you won't.
Maybe I won't.
My years in law enforcement, I used to see training officers. Those are guys who, and I was one, much to the chagrin of the department, who would train the new guys coming out to patrol. And it was a six-month process for the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. And it was really funny to see the contrast in some of these guys. A lot of them were new themselves. But they would strut around the station, and their chests would be out and receiving all the accolades and the plaudits of their peers, myself included at times, say, great arrest, great obs. I got the cokes after shift when things were going right. When things didn't go so well, they'd walk around the station with their head hanging low, their shoulders slumped, shuffling through the station, exclaiming to all in earshot in the vicinity, "My trainee really dropped the ball on this one." So to break them of this habit, to accept responsibility, build their character, and hopefully expedite their maturation process, I'd point out, as I'm prone to do humorously, that whenever something in the car went well, they walked around the station like they were Clint Eastwood or Duke Wayne. And by contrast, when events overwhelmed them and they were unable to deal with it, they walked around like Sergeant Schultz, "I know nothing." So I'd tell them, "You guys need to be consistent. Who are you? Are you the guy who's in charge or not? You can't have it both ways." But that seems to be missing in our conversation politically today, because whoever said you can't have it both ways, like Peter's saying about, oh, just spend all the money and you can declare bankruptcy, that's betraying our moral values. What kind of society are we having? And whoever said that, I can't remember, never met Obama or the powers that be today.
Well,
John,
I have to ask Peter for his response.
Give it to me, Peter.
I have no idea what that has to do with anything we're talking about today.
It's accepting personal responsibility and not rewarding people for bad behavior.
Everybody accepts responsibility for their actions. Everything you do, you're responsible for.
Apparently not. Just BK.
Yeah, apparently not. John, people declare bankruptcy all the time. There are consequences to it. States declare bankruptcy, governments declare bankruptcy, businesses declare bankruptcy, and a lot of the businesses that you think are so wonderful go to the government and say, "Give us $1 billion more because we need help." I don't know what you're talking about. Now, as far as accepting responsibility, everybody ultimately accepts responsibility for what they do. Whether they like it or not, they have to deal with the consequences of it, period. Nobody escapes that. Nobody. Look at Lance Armstrong. Look at Lance Armstrong.
Go ahead, it's your time, bro.
You can think that. I don't know if it's my time. Lance Armstrong has to accept accountability for what he did right now. Maybe the punishment.
He doesn't have to pay anything back.
Well, you think everything is just about money.
No, I don't. Not at all.
Well, you think it's about money and guns. John, I think you and I know we disagree, but I think we actually are far more aligned in our point of view than otherwise. The bottom line is this.
I agree with you, Peter, on anything, I'm going to have to reevaluate my position. Thank you.
Oh, I think you will have to reevaluate it, because I think it's the vast body of stuff we agree on. It's the differences that are the most interesting to talk about. No one wants to talk about the stuff we agree on. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Oh boy, that wasn't very exciting.
Probably so.
You know, I don't know how to fix the world. I've said this a billion times. I'll say it a billion more. It's a mess. It's a mess everywhere I look, everything I see. It's a god-awful mess. I don't know how to fix it. I know that I'm one guy, and every single day of my life, I do the right thing. I pay all my taxes. I work hard. I try to earn an income. I live with complete and utter responsibility for everything that I do. I have opinions. I express them. I disagree. But I'm just one guy, and I don't know how we're going to fix this great big mess. I have no idea. I have a funny feeling the mess is going to fix itself, because eventually everything's just going to collapse, and it'll all have to be rebuilt one way or another. I don't know what else to say other than that, except it's 2013, and by God, I hope everybody has a great new year.
Okay, folks. I have to close this episode. Thank you so much for taking part. Till next week, this is Simon saying goodbye.